Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, August 22nd, 2013. Bradley Manning had another surprise for us.
Woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I heard was a song outside my window, and the traffic wrote the words. It came a-ringing up like Christmas bells and wrapping up like fire.
On the Today Show, Manning's attorney David Coombs announced that Bradley Manning is wanting to be identified as a female. And he wants to be known now as Chelsea. And I say, Bradley, Chelsea, it's all fine with me. The statement attributed to Private Manning, quote, as I transition into this next phase of my life, I want everyone to know the real me. I am Chelsea Manning. I am a female. Given the way that I feel and have felt since childhood, I want to begin hormone therapy as soon as possible. I hope you will support me in this transition. Well, just first and foremost, I think that this is not terribly surprising. We know that he had issues about sexual identity. And now he, she is making clear what's going on inside. This is going to be challenging for the military as he will be sent to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to serve his up to 35 years in prison. And a spokeswoman for the prison said that it doesn't provide hormone therapy or gender reassignment surgery. And so this will be a new test, Manning versus the military. And I think it'll be very interesting. It's going to break down some barriers that were kind of unfinished business after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As to the sentence assigned to Manning, the New York Times correctly calls it excessive. 35 years is far too long a sentence by any standard. In more than 2 weeks of hearings, the Times says, government lawyers presented vague and largely speculative claims that Manning's leaks endangered lives and chilled diplomatic relations. And when you compare it to other sentences, it is extremely stiff. There's no doubt about that. And I alluded to that in my post on Facebook about yesterday's News and Comment podcast and the in-depth interview with Kevin Gostola about the very final chapter of the Bradley Manning court-martial. And my friend Christine Kraft, whom some of you may know, we have worked together at KGO Radio here in San Francisco. She's a lawyer, and she responded by saying, hey, he'll be out in 7 or 8 years. That's not an excessive sentence. Well, that's highly speculative. He will be eligible for parole based on good time and the credit, 112 days, that the court-martial judge assigned him for the cruel, unusual, and tortuous punishment that he received at Quantico during the first phase of his incarceration. But the idea that eligibility for parole equals release? No, that's not true. And given the climate, given that it will be military appeals courts that I believe would hear such a parole request, I don't think that Bradley Manning is going to see the outdoors outside of prison fences for a long time. I think it'll be at least 15 years. And, of course, it depends. The political climate could change, but at this point, it's very hard to predict. More news and comments straight ahead. I want to thank the people who support this podcast by subscribing, and let's name a name or two. How about Jeffrey England and Sharon Gadberry? They send me $5 every month, and you can do it too. We also have a great deal on our annual subscription, $50 a year. In either case, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, follow the link that says sign up, right under my mugshot in the upper left-hand corner. It's real easy. PayPal arranges for the monthly payments, and that's what keeps me going here. So I encourage you to do so. For new sign-ups on the annual $50 subscription, I've still got the Russ Archibald Kona coffee bag ready to ship to you, along with Sibel Edmonds' Classified Woman book. And while they last, I still have about half a dozen of the free Bradley Manning stickers. Maybe they'll update them with the name Chelsea, and I'll get some more to pass along to you. The other way you can support the Peter B. Collins Show is to take your web business to GoDaddy.com. They've become our sponsor, and if you do business with them, they will give me a little payment, a little referral fee. And I've been doing business with GoDaddy for over 10 years. Right now, you can sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth for starting as low as $1.99 a month with a free domain name. To get a special deal that also supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Yesterday, we touched on a bit the decision, an 85-page ruling that has been declassified and released. This was a ruling from the super-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And it gives us an interesting window, and of course, we can guess why it was released. It shows that, at least on occasion, the judges of the super-secret FISA court don't just rubber-stamp the actions that are requested to be authorized by the NSA or other law enforcement groups. So what we have here is an exception to that pattern. And that's worth noting. I really do think it's news, and it does surprise me a bit. The 85-page ruling, signed by Judge John D. Bates, who was then the chief judge of the FISA court, ripped into the NSA for repeatedly misrepresenting information to the court. He said the NSA repeatedly misled the court regarding the collection of tens of thousands of domestic emails and other internet communications on an annual basis. And the court noted in the declassified ruling that this was the third instance in less than 3 years in which the NSA has disclosed a substantial misrepresentation regarding the scope of a major collection program. A footnote said that in March 2009, the surveillance court learned the NSA analysts were using a phone log database in ways that went beyond what the judges believed to be the practice, because of a repeated inaccurate statement in government filings to the court. Quote, contrary to the government's repeated assurances, NSA had been routinely running queries of the metadata using querying terms that did not meet the standard for querying. Now, this is all a little bit vague, but what the judge is saying is that the NSA has been playing games with the FISA court, which we're told by the president is one of the checks on unconstitutional activities by the NSA. Well, Mark Rumold of the Electronic Frontier Foundation that brought the suit that forced the release of this document says, the opinion illustrates that the way the court is structured now, it cannot serve as an effective check on the NSA because it's wholly dependent on the representations that NSA makes to it. It has no ability to investigate, and it's clear that the NSA representations have not been entirely candid to the court. This dovetails with what government apologist Judge Reggie Walton, who is now the chief judge of the FISA court, allowed last week or the week before, when he said, you know, I have no way of verifying the information that the NSA puts before me. Now, while Judge Bates had ruled that it was acceptable for NSA to collect and store bundled communications, he said the agency was not doing enough to minimize the purely domestic and unrelated messages that are bundled in those packages to protect Americans' privacy. Now, at the same time, the Obama administration released a partly redacted semi-annual report about compliance incidents, and, shock, it found that there had been no willful violations of the rules and that fewer than 1% of queries by analysts involved errors. Now, that sounds pretty comforting, doesn't it? But listen to the weasel words here. No willful violations of the rules. We know they claim that there's been a lot of accidental collection into the tens of thousands of intercepts. And then they say fewer than 1% of the queries involved errors. Well, just how many queries were there? Because 1% of a big number is itself a very big number. And this is one of the things we have to watch for, is the dissembling, the sleight of hand, the spin that is coming from these alleged disclosures. And I still haven't gotten over the embassy shutdown that was based on what they tell us was an intercept between al-Zawahiri and a leader of al-Qaeda in Yemen. Who leaked that? And will they face 35 years in a military prison for it? Of course not. And we know that that whole episode now was bullshit. There were no attacks on American facilities at the end of Ramadan. Did the moves by the administration to shut these embassies and consulates break up an effort to attack those facilities? Well, we may never know. But because these boys keep crying wolf, and because they're doing it to try to preserve unconstitutional, invasive surveillance programs, we can't trust them. And I believe that that breakdown in trust is the biggest problem that surfaces from the summer of leaks. Now here comes Dennis Kucinich, former Democratic congressman from Cleveland, a guy who I like and admire. And I don't hold it against him that he took a job as a commentator on the Fox News Channel. I've yet to see him there because I rarely watch the Fox News Channel. But he's telling it like it is, and he is unencumbered now that he's no longer a member of Congress. Kucinich, quote, "It's time to punch the NSA's ticket. They've ruined the brand. They've destroyed the idea of privacy. We talk about the death penalty for individuals, which I oppose, but I think there needs to be for government agencies that so broadly betray the public interest. There needs to be a measure of responsibility. And if they go beyond the pale, which the NSA has, they ought to be abolished. We don't need the spying." Another quote, "It's illegal to lie to Congress, but everyone lies to Congress. As soon as they raise their right hand, watch out. Clapper should be held responsible, but he won't be, because that's the condition we're in right now." On Ed Snowden, Kucinich, "In a just world, Snowden, we'd be having a ticker tape parade for him. But that's not what's going to happen, so we have to get back to political solutions." One more bite from Dennis Kucinich, quote, "We have the CIA, we have the FBI, a dozen other intelligence structures. I think it's time to punch the NSA stick in here. They've ruined the brand. They've destroyed the idea of privacy. We need some kind of symbolic and actually profound approach here that says, look, you violated something very dear to the American people. You don't get to do that." And he goes on to say that there needs to be the death penalty for government agencies that so broadly betray the public interest. The NSA should be abolished. Good for you. I've got an interview request into the office of Dennis Kucinich, and I hope that he will join us on an upcoming in-depth interview here at peterbcollins.com very soon. A couple of years ago, we brought you an interview with a filmmaker named Andy Abrahams Wilson. His film is called Under Our Skin, and it takes a close look at chronic Lyme disease. Lyme disease originated in Lyme, Connecticut. It is mostly passed by ticks on deer. And until recently, it was believed to be a very minor condition, at least in terms of the numbers. And as the film Under Our Skin documents, the medical establishment, the insurance industry, they all reject the notion that Lyme disease can be a chronic condition. But there are many people whose experiences directly contradict that. And now the highly credible Center for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a report which shows that the number of new cases of Lyme disease each year is 10 times higher than was previously estimated. It's about 300,000 people a year, not 20,000 to 30,000, as we had been told. And I want to single out our listener, Natalie, in Montana. who recently emailed me. She had gone back to listen to our interview about the film Under Our Skin. And Natalie herself is combating a long-term condition related to an infection from Lyme disease. I don't know all the particulars, but she emailed me about a month ago and said, you ought to have Andy Abrahams-Wilson back on the show. Well, we're going to do that. Andy asked for a little time because he has just begun work on a second edition of Under Our Skin. And when he gets a little further along, we'll have him back on the program, and I'm sure that he will have more to say about the new statistics that appear to be far more accurate about the level of Lyme infections in the general population. It's about time the Obama administration is escalating efforts to restore the part of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down at the end of June by the U.S. Supreme Court. They're focusing right now on Texas, but there's a crisis in North Carolina where the voter suppression tactics are incredible. Now, the element of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down by the court had required states like Texas and North Carolina to get permission from the voting rights section of the Justice Department in advance of, say, imposing a photo ID law or closing the precincts on college campuses as they're doing in North Carolina. But without it, these states have just gone full speed ahead to use all kinds of legal maneuvers to prevent people from voting. And it's not a surprise that most of the people they want to prevent from voting are likely to vote for Democrats. And so the Justice Department, announced by Attorney General Holder, said that this represents the department's latest action to protect voting rights, but it will not be our last. Well, I think there's a voting rights emergency in this country. And I'm glad to see the Justice Department at least addressing Texas, but there is certainly much more work to do. There's a news story that ordinarily I probably wouldn't have included here today. Dateline Seoul, South Korea. And it talks about the ugly conditions in the prison camps of North Korea. And it profiles Shin Dong-hyuk. He said his earliest memory of life in a North Korean prison camp was the public execution that inmates were forced to watch. He was 5 years old. They were so hungry that they devoured live rats and the uncooked hooves of a goat that prison guards had thrown away after slaughtering the animal. One 7-year-old girl was clubbed to death for stealing a few grains of wheat. And this man said he felt lucky when a warden ordered the tip of his finger chopped off rather than execution for the offense of damaging a piece of sewing equipment. And these are just some examples of the brutal, barbaric conditions in North Korea, particularly in prison camps. And while I was on vacation, I did something different. I read 40 to 50 books a year, but they're almost all nonfiction. They're books that I read to prepare for interviews for this program. But for my birthday earlier this year, Rick and Irene gave me a copy of a novel called The Orphan Master's Son. And it's written by Adam Johnson, who is a scholar at Stanford University. And I want to recommend this book to you because I picked it up on the plane on my way out on vacation and I had a hard time putting it down. And it is the story of a boy who was, he grew up in an orphanage in North Korea. And through twists and turns, he ends up impersonating one of the top leaders of the North Korean government, interacts with the dear leader, who at that time was Kim Jong-il. And the level of detail in this book related to the treatment of people, not only in the prison camps, but in the general society, and the police state that operates in North Korea 24/7, where you would never say anything critical of the dear leader anytime, anywhere, because if someone hears it, you could be dead. And I just want to recommend it to you if you have a chance. Pick up The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson. It's quite an eye-opener. Greg Palast is back with a great dispatch. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. He fingers Larry Summers, who appears to be the front runner to replace Bernanke as chair of the Federal Reserve when Bernanke's term expires in January. Larry Summers is a guy who was an arrogant SOB when he ran Harvard. But what Palast exposes is that during the final years of the Clinton administration, Larry Summers was busy doing the bidding of corporate bankers in the U.S. and around the world. He led the charge to dismantle the Glass-Steagall Act. And there's much more detail in Greg Palast's report, and I hope you'll read it, but he offers clear proof that Larry Summers should never be nominated or confirmed as Federal Reserve Chair. Well, Bob Filner, a former congressman who got elected last year as mayor of San Diego, appears to be in his final 24 hours in that job. Word is that on Friday he will resign as part of a deal where the city will pay some of the legal fees in the 18 different allegations of sexual harassment that have been publicly announced or legally filed against him. And it seems like Filner was trying to compete with the record of Arnold Schwarzenegger to see how many women he could grope and get away with it. And Arnie got away with it for a long time, till well after he left the governor's office here in California and revealed that he had shtupped the maid. Yes, his youngest child was born a week before or after the offspring of Arnold and the housekeeper. And Bob Filner doesn't have any illegitimate kids. So far, there's no allegation that he actually shtupped any of these women. He was just gross in his public behavior. And he had hands that he apparently can't control. And I just wonder what reality show Bob Filner will pop up on. Maybe America's Got Talent? I don't know. Couple of items from here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The city and county of San Francisco is suing a Las Vegas psychiatric hospital for dumping patients in California. Some 500 mental patients from Nevada, apparently going back as far as 2008, were given bus tickets to cities in California where they were just dumped. These psychiatric patients weren't given resources at the destination. Authorities here weren't notified that these mental patients from Nevada were coming into California. And San Francisco has been able to establish that at least 20 patients ended up here since 2008 and cost the taxpayers here by at least $500,000. And I don't know how often this goes on, but it sure is ugly. The idea that medical professionals would say, well, they're cutting our budget here, so we're just going to ship you out to the wind and see what happens. California's a great place. They have mild winters. You won't mind a thing. That's so subhuman. I've talked often about the rogue utility called Pacific Gas and Electric. They're at it again. You may recall that in 2010, September, almost 3 years ago now, there was a gas pipeline explosion that killed 8 people and blew up 38 homes. The Patsy Public Utilities Commission here seems to be prepared to fine PG&E as much as $2 billion for its gross negligence and errors. But right before the 4th of July, the rogue utility filed some documents with the Public Utilities Commission. And apparently there are administrative law judges there who are actually paying attention. One of them wrote, PG&E appears to be revealing a substantial error. And what they're referring to is that in this filing, PG&E, without acknowledging the contradiction, amended its statements about the nature of pipeline safety issues in the area where the blast occurred just 3 years ago. And originally, they said, for example, that a certain pipeline route, which is known as Line 101, was that they'd completely identified the route and that it was safe enough to boost back to standard gas pressure levels. Then last fall, when they dug up the connector line in the town of San Carlos, PG&E workers discovered that the pipe was of lesser quality than company records indicated. And that's what they tried to slip into the filing right before the 4th of July, hoping that no one would notice. It's another indication of the corruption of the management at PG&E, and that profits trump safety 11 out of 10 times over at Pacific Gas and Electric. A couple of quick comments in emails that came through to the Peter B. Collins Show. A guy named Greg Nell, and Greg, if I've been in touch with you before, I don't recall. And he may be just spamming different websites of podcasts and progressive commentators. But he writes, "You decry military bloodshed, but most progressives ignore the machine gunning of Coptic Christians in their homes and the burning of their churches by Morsi supporters. Why is that okay? I urge other progressives to include this bloodshed of innocence in their condemnation." Well, Greg, I appreciate the point you're making. And I deplore all kinds of violence, whether it occurs at the hands of the generals who are now running Egypt after the coup that the Obama administration doesn't call a coup, or whether it was when Mohamed Morsi had his one-year run as the president of Egypt, and clearly the Muslim Brotherhood, his group, was empowered, and certain things happened, including attacks on Coptic Christians. I am aware of that. But that doesn't form the basis to say that this military coup is somehow an act of democracy, or that the generals are a legitimate body ruling the government of Egypt. And my guess is that you're an activist who is posting these comments for your own partisan reasons. But I think that the U.S. must cut off aid to Egypt, and the sooner, the better. Fewer people, hopefully, will die. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are authorized to spread far and wide. So go right ahead. And thank you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until